By the way, just again, just a comment about how this beauty contest was set up. An amazing thing. You see in the story of the Megillah that each woman was taken into this harem and she was prepared for 12 months. It was a whole year till she would even come into the king. I mean, it's like, marinating meat or something. It describes here that for 6 months she would be coated in Shemen Hamor, which is myrrh oil, a certain aromatic perfume. And then for 6 months with various spices and the like, and she would come to Ahasuerus only after an entire year. And the way it would work, again, it's something that I think the important thing for us to realize is what a degradation, what a humiliation, what a Chilul Hashem this was experienced by someone like Esther. That she's held in this situation for an entire year, and then there's a one-night tryout. Ahasuerus is with each of these people one night. And after he goes through his entire rotation, he then decides who is the person he wants to be the designated queen. But the other women don't go free either, meaning to say any woman that is brought to the palace remains in the harem, but only one woman becomes the queen. Everyone else is a mistress in the harem. There was a concept that once you were taken by the king, you could not be released into the common pool anymore. So this was mamish the way it was, that at night she would come in the morning she would turn out, and indeed there were two different pools. There was the pool of the women who Ahasuerus had not yet been with, which was under the jurisdiction of a man called Haggai, like two different people. And once she had been used, she went into a different person's custody, Shashgaz. In other words, just making the point there were two different pools here, and at that point she would not come back to the king until the king summons her. That's why Esther, in fact, this even applied to someone like Esther, who was the head queen, which is why we find that when Mordechai tells Esther to go to Ahasuerus, he says, I cannot go in until I am summoned, right? It's based on the procedure that was set up. That's why it's a little ambiguous to me when it says Esther was taken to Ahasuerus in the month of Teves, the seventh year. It's not clear to me if that refers to the original taking, her seizure into the harem, or her designation as queen. It's not exactly borer in the pshat as to what stage that refers to. Okay, now then, if you look at verse 19, again, so some of these just want to point out difficulties in pshat, even in translation. Look at verse 19. Okay, so verse 17 says, the king loved Esther more than all other women. She found favor in his eyes from all other virgins, even though she was not a virgin according to Chazal. Right, I'm reading verse 17. Vayasem keser malchus bereisha. He put the crown of the queen on her head. Viamlichaha tachas vashti. And he made her queen instead of Vashti. Okay, so far so good. Then it says, Vayas hamelech mishte gadol. The king made a great party. Night of Ahasuerus is into parties, right? So there's the whole Megillah started off with a 180-day party followed by 7 days. Now he has another excuse to make a party. Vavadav Eis Mishte Esther. This was the banquet in honor of Queen Esther. But this party was very beneficial to some of the people. Hanacha Lamedinos Asa. Hanacha, even today in modern Hebrew, a hanacha is a discount, or etc. So this was a tax exemption. He exempted, we don't know exactly what form this took, but essentially he exempted the people to pay a certain amount of taxation in honor of this particular event. Vayitein maseis kiyad hamelech, and he gave gifts to all of the assembled in accordance with the king's wealth. Okay, so far so good. We have the picture. After this incredible exploitation of women and this tremendous degradation of a righteous person, of whom Ahasuerus doesn't even know that she is Jewish, Ahasuerus makes a celebration. But then, verse 19 throws into the wrench a very unusual event that we don't even understand. It then says, Ubihi kabeitz besulot shenitz. When the virgins were gathered a second time, Mordechai was sitting in the gate of the king, and Esther did not tell her nation, etc. So this is very perplexing. What is this gathering of virgins a second time? it's already been described that Achashverosh had this contest. He chose Esther. So what is the Hikabetz Basulo Shenis? There seems to be a second contest that's here. Chazal say, Rashi quotes this from the Gemara, Chazal say the following, that Achashverosh is very intrigued by this mysterious woman that apparently he feels connected to, who refuses to reveal her identity. So Achashverosh turns to a trusted advisor, none other than Mordechai. Mordechai happens to already be someone that has the trust of Achashverosh. In fact, the phrase, when it says Mordechai sits in the gate of the king, so how do we picture that? Mordechai sits in the gate of the king. Now, the simple meaning is, he's just hanging around the palace to always find out about Esther. Right? He's hanging around, kind of just walking around. But there is a medrash that says the following. The concept of sitting in the gate of the king is an expression for a judge. In fact, we always find in Tanakh, even for Jewish judges, that the common place where judges would be situated, they would hold court, is the gate of the city gate. Now you understand, the concept of a city gate would resemble something like Shar Shechem, right? This is an ancient city gate, or Shar Yafo, before it was opened up because of the Kaiser's horse. You know why, I'm sure you know this, you know why Shar Yafo is open, right? Shar Yafo is not connected. The concept was that originally the gate was a regular gate. Suleiman the Magnificent, as he liked to call himself, built a gate. And Kaiser Wilhelm, who was the king of the Kaiser of Germany, wanted to make a pilgrimage to Israel. It was, I believe it was 1917, it was shortly after, or actually in the middle of World War I. And the roof of the gate was not tall enough to accommodate the Kaiser on his white horse. So the Kaiser would have, in fact this was deliberately so, Suleiman wanted to make things so that any visitor would have to get off the horse to walk under to show submission to the Suleiman. So Kaiser Wilhelm refused to enter the city unless he could do so on his horse. I'm not sure what his pull was, because then he was under the British mandate, but for whatever reason, Britain wanted to accommodate the German Kaiser, and therefore they opened up the Shar Yafo, so it doesn't have a roof anymore. But be it as it may, if you imagine a gate like that, this is in the Chumash. The Chumash talks about, right, Shoftim v'shotrim. Terry says, you should make judges, Titein lecha b'chal sha'arecha, put them in your gates, the city gate. Or if you remember the story of Rus and Boaz, when Boaz finally decides to marry Rus, he takes her to the gate of the city. And he discusses this with the, again, Chazal understand it, with the Beis Din that is there. So similarly, even in the non-Jewish world, the gates of the palace or the gates of the city were a place of justice. People would go to the palace and ask for justice, etc. So it is said that when it says Mordechai is sitting in the gate of the Melech, it's the fact that Mordechai already had the capacity of some type of judge or royal advisor. And Chazal say that's the connection to this second contest of the virgins. Achashverosh, this is so strange, Achashverosh turns to his good friend Mordechai and says, Mordechai, how do I get this mysterious woman to tell me who she is? Which is an amazing thing. It's like Achashverosh doesn't know that this woman grew up in Mordechai's home. Achashverosh doesn't know that this woman was in fact, and is in fact, Mordechai's wife. Apparently. But he says, so Mordechai looks at this as an opportunity to come up with a plan to get Esther out of there. He's grasping at straws. And he says, you know, the one thing women are is jealous of rivals. So why don't you reopen the beauty contest, as it were, and Esther will be so devastated by the envy she'll feel towards potential rivals that she'll tell you everything to gain your love. But of course, Mordechai's motivation is, hopefully, although it's hard to know why they weren't taken the first round. That's why it's difficult. I mean, if they're so great, why weren't they taken the first round? But hopefully, the concept is, Rashi learns, that that Achashverosh will find somebody else that he wants more and let Esther go. That's the cheshbon. But again, it's a little difficult because if there had been this massive contest of all the best candidates, it's hard to know why there would necessarily be somebody better unless somebody, you know, reaches a certain age. We don't know what minimum age requirements there were for participation in this particular thing. So that's how Rashi learns. Rashi learns, see, he connects verse 19 with verse 20, because verse 19 talks about a gathering of the virgins a second time, and verse 20 says Esther still did not tell her nation, meaning Rashi intimates from that the purpose of the second gathering from Achashverosh's standpoint was to make Esther tell her people. Okay. Again, I have another kasha on Rashi's pshat, because l'chaira like this, if it's true that every person that the king was with was never released back into the general pool, so to speak, then even if Achashverosh replaces Esther with another queen, that's not going to get Esther out of the palace. But it will minimize, presumably, the amount of time the king is physically with her. So consequently, that itself would be of great benefit. Okay. All right. So now verse 21 then describes how Mordechai himself got into the king's graces. In other words, see, this is a little bit of this is what in English is called a past perfect, meaning to say the way we understand this is Mordechai overhearing the assassination plot did not happen after this event. Because if it happened after the event, we'd have the problem, how come Mordechai was already an advisor a little bit before? But it's explaining what, this is kind of going backwards. It's explaining the following thing had already happened, which therefore put Mordechai in a position of some influence. And this is the overhearing of the assassination plots, right? There are two officers here, Bigson and Seresh. They are called Shnei. By the way, the word Saris is a very fascinating thing. You know, you'll notice throughout the Megillah, and this is also in the Chumash itself, throughout the Megillah, the king's officers are called Sarisim. Now, if you remember, that's also true with Potiphar. Potiphar, the one who was worked for Paro and was Yosef's master, it's also called Saris Paro. Now, yeah, a Saris is a eunuch.
Yeah.
That's correct. A eunuch is a person that is castrated. Now, there are Mephorshim that actually say that the custom was in the ancient world, not among the Jews, but in the ancient world, that the intimate officials of the king's household were actually castrated in order to prevent improper relationships with the king. In fact, Hegai and Shashgaz, those two guys that were in charge of the harem, are also described as Saris, and one can imagine why that would be so. Kind of an ancient law of sexual to prevent sexual harassment and the like, I think. Now, if this sounds, you know, so amazing, how could anyone be so barbaric? Keep in mind that until the mid-19th century, kids who were in certain papal choirs were castrated to keep their voices high. I mean, this was, what's the Italian word? Castrato or something. There's a certain type of very high soprano, which is based on that idea. So the concept that this could not be done by civilized people, of course these are not necessarily civilized people anyway, but is really not the MS, because things like this were done for less, you know, important concerns. So some say that is serious.
Opera singers,
the what?
People who sang opera?
Yes.
Yes.
Well,
okay.
No, the choir. In other words, I meant that the Pope had a special choir there may have been other situations as well, but I do know that there were the castratos in the papal choirs. Yeah.
That
gives rise to
another question.
If yeah.
Mordechai became also an intimate advisor to the king. Did
yes.
he risk castration?
Well, again, apparently not, because again, Mordechai was not within the palace, right? Mordechai, I guess he knew where to keep his distance. Mordechai is always described as being at the palace gates.
Oh, okay.
So indeed, if you weren't within the palace confines, you were kind of safe from that. Also, keep in mind too, Mordechai was very old, so it could very well be that whole issue was not. It didn't necessarily apply to everybody. Maybe it only applied to suspicious characters, etc. You know, we don't know all the details. Now, some of Farshim don't learn this, by the way. Some of Farshim just learn that Saris is just a biblical term for a high officer, a sire. It does not necessarily connote the idea of castration. But some do say it refers literally to being a eunuch.
Okay.
Doesn't the Tanakh mention eunuchs working in the temple?
I think that's just the translation of the same word.
The same word that they're being
translated. Right. So it doesn't necessarily have that extreme meaning, right? But of course, the word saris as a eunuch does appear in Tanakh absolutely. In other words, in Yeshayahu's prophecies, you know, the Haftorah that we read on a fast day, which begins, "Dirshu Hashem bihi matzo," seek out God where you can find Him. Right? This is the famous Haftorah. So it talks about the fact that if there's a certain comfort at the end of the Haftorah to those who are not blessed with children. It says, "Al Yomar Hasaris." The eunuch should not say, in looking at his life, "Hein ani eitz yavesh," behold, I am like a dry tree that has not produced any fruit. And Hashem says to those sarisim that if you keep my mitzvahs, you will have eternal life. And, you know, the mitzvahs that you do will be your children. So clearly the word saris is used in places in Tanakh to refer to that. But whether that's the connotation of the officer or the prince, that's a machlokus among the mefarshim. So what does Pasuk Chaf Aleph tell us? Pasuk Chaf Aleph describes that Mordechai is sitting around the king's gates, and Mordechai overhears two slaves, or two sarisim of Achashverosh, planning to murder King Achashverosh, and Mordechai tells Esther, and Esther tells Achashverosh. Now it's very interesting that it's brought down that Bigson and Seresh were conversing, not even in the Persian language. They were conversing in some other language. They figured nobody would understand them. But Mordechai was a member of the Sanhedrin. And this is phenomenal. To be a member of the Supreme Sanhedrin, you have to know 71 languages, which are considered to be the basic languages of the world. Now, why do you have to know 71 languages? Why is that so important? So the Gemara explains, because the halacha is the Sanhedrin, when they hear eyewitness testimony about any matter, are not allowed to use interpreters. Right? So consequently, sometimes in Swahili, the Sanhedrin must be in a position to be able to understand the testimony. Now again, la halacha, it's not really clear if this fits, because according to the halacha, you don't need every single member. Let's say you have a 71 member court. You just need some of the judges to be able to understand, and they could communicate it to the other judges. In other words, the halacha, in other words, to the extent you're relating this to the halacha would not compel that every individual judge know all of the languages. It does say, in the Sanhedrin, somebody on the Sanhedrin must know every possible language. But Chazal, in this Medrash, seems to understand that if you were on the Sanhedrin, you knew all 71 languages, and therefore Mordechai was able to know exactly what they were planning.
When you just said, like, basically, we are explaining over here that how Mordechai became to be one of
Achashverosh's advisors. That's correct.
Now, yeah. You said in those days.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
From what I understand, he told it to Queen Esther, but like in those days, we mean like in the past, right?
And, yes, the way we're interpreting it, it's not, no. We don't mean the distant. In other words, it was around this time. All I'm saying is that Esther became queen first. No, you're right. There's no question. Esther became queen before Mordechai became the king's advisor. But after Esther became queen, there was the story of Bigson Vesaresh, which made Mordechai the advisor. And in the preceding verse, where Chazal say Achashverosh turned to Mordechai for advice, that was after this event.
The reason why he turned, because there were like, I don't know, seven virgins, you said? I mean, a lineup of the virgins over there, right?
Well, that's the second
one. Esther wasn't yet queen.
No, that's not true. Because Pasuk 19 is talking about after Esther was queen, but there was a second gathering of virgins that Mordechai had encouraged as a means of perhaps he'll dump Esther. Yeah, in other words, that's the second group. Esther was already queen. Right?
Why did he encourage the second gathering? So she was queen already.
No. So Rashi says the opposite. Rashi says that Mordechai was hoping that Achashverosh would find somebody he liked better in the second gathering and release Esther. See, we have to understand, contrary to the secular view, that this is such a great thing that Esther is taken as queen. We have to keep in mind that Chazal understand that Mordechai and Esther desperately want to get out of that situation, because they don't yet know what their divine role is. To them, they see this as a tragedy. Okay. Yeah.
How do they explain this question?
Which pasuk?
Well, it says that a second.
That's saying, well, Rashi says that after Esther was taken as queen, Mordechai encouraged Achashverosh to make a second contest, because Mordechai was secretly hoping, and Esther too, that they would, Achashverosh would find somebody in the second contest that he would like better than Esther. You see? It didn't work.
The position that the other people take, think that it's not that she...
How do they interpret it? I'm not sure. I don't know how they interpret it. I mean, again, this pasuk is a very strong support for Chazal. You know, I don't know how they interpret the... This is a difficult pasuk. If you look at a standard English translation, it literally does not make sense. Esther is already queen. There's already a party. And then it talks about a second gathering of the virgins. Lefi pashat pshat, without Chazal, there is literally no reason why there is a second gathering of virgins. This is an example that Chazal's interpretations are not merely, you know, midrashim and things, but that the truth is they fit the actual simple meaning of the verse in a much better way. Which of course is emes. We should believe that Chazal's interpretations are not superimposed on verses, but they are actually the explanation of the simple meaning of the narrative. Now, there's one other thing the Gemara comments here. If you look at Pasuk Chaf Beis, look what it says. The matter was known to Mordechai. He told Esther. Why didn't he tell Achashverosh? Very simply, because at this point in time, Mordechai didn't have the connections to go straight to the king. He tells Esther. Esther tells the Melech in the name of Mordechai. Very significant. She does not take credit. She gives it to Mordechai. And the Gemara says, this is a halacha that's brought down, Kol ha'omer davor b'shem omra. When you say something over in the name of the person who told it to you, you don't say, in other words, if somebody tells you a Torah thought, you don't just say, this is my explanation, but you say, I heard this from somebody. Mevi ge'ula la'olam. You can bring redemption into the world by Davor B'Shem Amro. Proof: Esther said this over B'Shem Mordechai. Now keep in mind how important this was. Let's imagine Esther had not said it to Mordechai. I'm sorry, Esther had not said it in the name of Mordechai. So Mordechai would never have been inscribed in the king's book as somebody the king honored. So, the whole incident, as it were, of having to honor Mordechai, which is part of the redemption of the Jewish people, would never have taken place. So, we see that if you say something b'shem omro, you could bring redemption to the Jewish people. And this is a halacha. In other words, you always say, and that's why if you look at the Gemara, you notice how the Gemara is so particular in trying to tell you exactly who said what to whom. Like it'll say, Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav. And if there's some uncertainty, the Gemara will say, but some people say, Rav Yehuda said it in the name of Shmuel. And sometimes you'll have a list of five names. It'll say, Rabbi so-and-so said in the name of Rabbi so-and-so, who said it in the name of Rabbi so-and-so, who said it in the name of Rabbi so-and-so. You may have to seven names. And then it'll say, and some people say that number six and number seven were two different people. So sometimes you might feel like, you know, who cares? You know, let's just have the statement. But the answer is, Chazal were very, very attuned to the vital importance of trying to preserve the Davor B'Shem Amro, because this was considered to be a schus that brings redemption into the world. And therefore, if we were not sure if the Shem Amro was Reuven or the Shem Amro was Shimon, we record in the Talmud both possibilities, just so we'll keep a sense of Shem Amro. Now there is a machlokas actually like this. Let's say, for example, we have a lot of intermediate links. Let's say, for example, the Zohar says something. Okay, so if I'm writing down a statement that's from the Zohar, I have to say it says in the Zohar. But let's say I didn't get it from the Zohar. Let's say I got it because Rabbi Akiva Eiger brings down the Zohar. Do I have to say I saw in Rabbi Akiva Eiger who brings down the Zohar? Or do I simply go back and say the original source? From the Megillah you don't have a proof because Mordechai was the original source of the information. But from the Gemara, apparently, you do see in the Gemara that the Gemara is concerned with intermediate links as well. The Gemara is not limited to the ultimate source. And also there's another concern of Gaiva, and that is the Selakes. If I were to say, I saw it in the Zohar, if I were to say the Zohar says, so people are going to walk away thinking, oh, what a great rabbi, he knows the Zohar, he knows Kabbalah. On the other hand, if I just say, well, I saw it in, you know, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, or I saw it in the Art Scroll, you know, even that, you know, that way it's more of an honest thing. So I know the Stipler was very, very concerned. And the Stipler, of course, was a God of the Torah. But he was once concerned because he said something in the name of the Birchei Yosef, which is a book on Shulchan Aruch, but it's not widely learned. It was written by the Chidah, a very great Gadol. And the Stipler was agonizing afterwards. Oh, people will think, you know, I know all of the Birchei Yosef, but no, I saw it in Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you know, who quoted the Birchei Yosef, and you know, he wanted to kind of get everybody back again for a public apology that he didn't get it from that source. Of course, you know, essentially what the Stipler is saying is, I don't know every Birchei Yosef, I just know every Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you know, so it's different, you know. But but there is a concern for that false modesty, particularly when you're dealing with books that are not widely learned, like the Talmud Yerushalmi or Kabbalah. So if you got them from an intermediate source, it is proper, in order not to convey a misleading impression as to your greatness in Torah, to indicate the intermediate source that you got it from. But this is the concept of davar b'shem amro, to say things in the name of the person who told them to you. And this is a halacha that is derived from Megillah, because it says, Vatzomer Esther Lamelech b'shem Mordechai, and Bigson B'Seresh is Arhung, and this was inscribed in the book of Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim are the chronicles, the king's records. Okay, so Perek Aleph and Beis are the precursors to Haman. Let's see a look at all the precursors. Esther is queen. Mordechai is in the king's good graces. Now you see that these are the two elements that will wind up saving the Jews. Because when Achashverosh discovers that Esther is the Jewish queen and Mordechai is his great trusted advisor, that is the thing that sets into motion the downfall of Haman. So as we indicated many times, the structure of Perek Aleph and Beis is Hashem gives us the cure before He gives us the illness. Before we even get the problem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets up the elements of the story that will be necessary to save us. The ascendancy of Mordechai, the ascendancy of Esther. And that's why Perek Gimel begins, Achar HaDvarim Ha'ela, after these events, only after, then there is a man who seems to come from nowhere, Haman, right? This is where the kids can start making noise. Haman, the son of Hamdasa, Ha'agagi. Now, again, do remember that although this is the very first time in the Megillah that Haman is mentioned, according to Chazal, the very official who gave Achashverosh advice, remember that's back in Perek Aleph, the very official who gave Achashverosh advice to kill Vashti was a man called Mimuchan. And Chazal say Mimuchan is another name for Haman, and it comes from the word Mimuchan. He is designated and prepared for his own destruction. In other words, it's so ironic. Who is responsible for Esther to be queen? Haman, who gave the idea to kill Vashti. Now, the word Agagi is very important, the Agagite, but Agag was the king of Amalek that Shaul was supposed to kill. King Saul was supposed to kill, and King Saul did not kill. And although Agag was murdered, was killed by Shmuel, the prophet, in that little bit of time, Agag impregnated a woman who was not found, and that woman's child was the ancestor of Haman. Right? So Haman, according to Chazal, again, it's interesting to know, in the actual text of the Megillah, Haman is not defined as Amalek. You don't see necessarily Haman as Amalek. Doesn't say. But Chazal say Agagi means descended from Agag. The only Agag we know of in Tanakh is the king of Amalek. And consequently, the whole story of Megillah is an example of Amalek once again trying to destroy us. And again, we went over a lot of this just to remind yourself of the connection, that Shaul is from the tribe of Binyamin. He failed to kill Agag. Mordechai and Esther are descended from King Shaul. And therefore, part of what's going on in Megillah is that Mordechai and Esther, who are descended from Shaul, are misake. They rectify the unfinished business that Shaul failed to carry out. That Shaul failed to kill Amalek. Mordechai and Esther are instrumental in the downfall of Amalek. Yeah.
Also
from Shaul. Right, that's right. That's correct. Had children who were not killed, and indeed, Amalek continued and perhaps continues to exist. Sometimes that's even for the good, because the Gemara records that there were descendants of Amalek who actually converted to Judaism, who became great teachers of Torah in B'nai B'rach. That even the evil nation of Amalek, if they embrace Torah and mitzvahs with sincerity, they are welcome. By the way, let me just tell you a little thought about this. According to this Chazal, even Amalek, the most evil of the nations that you're supposed to utterly destroy, Amalek can convert and join Klal Yisrael. If they're sincere, if they're not doing it right. Now here's the question. There is only one nation, or actually two nations, who even if they convert, they cannot marry into the Jewish people. Does anyone remember which two nations? No, Mitzrayim for three generations, but Ammon and Moab. The Ammonites and the Moabites, yeah. Which one?
Where is Amnon?
Amnon? Ammon or Amnon?
Ammon.
Ammon, okay. Ammon and Moab is essentially the east bank of the Jordan. It's where modern Jordan is today. Now let me explain. If you remember who Ammon and Moab were, Ammon and Moab, Lot is Abraham's nephew. Lot is Avram's nephew. And when Sodom was destroyed, and Lot and his two daughters fled into the mountains, the daughters believed there was no one else left in the world. They look out at the plains of the Jordan Valley, and all they see is destruction. Where Sodom, around the Dead Sea. So they figured, there's no one else left in the world. We have to keep the world alive. So they got their father drunk, and one night the oldest daughter was with her father, and she got pregnant. And the next night, Lot got drunk again. Actually, Lot is more responsible for the second night than the first night, because he knew what happened. And the younger daughter was with him. And the older daughter had a son, and she named that son Moav, which means from my father, Me'av. And the younger daughter named the son Ammon, from my nation. The Gemara mentions that the younger daughter is a bit more reticent and modest than the older daughter. That's why Ammon is a little better. But that is the nation, and they founded the nations of Ammon and Moab, which are in the east bank of the Jordan, etc. Now, part of the Ammonite and Moabite territory was later conquered by the Amori, and the land of the Amori was then in turn conquered by the Jewish people, and that was the two and a half tribes, Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menasheh. However, the rest of the territory east of the Jordan belonged to Ammon and Moab, and God specifically commanded the Jewish people, do not wage war against your cousins, the Ammonites and the Moabites, because that is the land I have given to Lot, and it is not to be Jewish territory until the coming of the Mashiach. So unlike Amalek, we are not commanded to wage war aggressively against Ammon and Moab. And in fact, it is forbidden to wage war against Ammon and Moab. And yet, the Torah makes the point, an Ammonite or a Moabite may not enter the congregation of God, even if they want to become Jewish. We are not allowed to marry them. Now, of course, the halacha has major exceptions. Yeah, so the Gemara explains, though, that this prohibition only applies to the male Moabites and Ammonites. It does not apply to the female Moabites and Ammonites, which is why, of course, Rus, the famous Rus, who is the great-grandmother of David HaMelech, and ultimately the ancestor of Mashiach, actually comes from Moab. But in terms of the males, they can't marry. Now, why is that so? So look what the Torah says. The Torah says, because when you were traveling in the desert to try to get into the land of Israel, and you wanted to cut through, because remember, the way the Jews traveled is, although Egypt, they weren't really a semicircle here, because Egypt is west. Egypt is west of Eretz Israel, right? Egypt is southwest. And yet the Jews traveled around till they were east of the Jordan River. And then they crossed from east to west, right? They crossed east to west. Now, so in order to get through, they had to go through various lands like Ammon and Moab, etc. And they asked the Moabites to give them food and water, which they would pay for. And the Moabites refused to even give them food and water. And of course, the Moabites were the people who hired the famous sorcerer, Bilam. Right? Bilam is half curse, will travel. Right? Bilam was a very, very effective ancient sorcerer, a prophet who could curse people, etc. That didn't work too well from their perspective. Every time Bilam wanted to curse them, it turned into a blessing. But Bilam gave them another piece of advice. Get your women dressed up very beautifully and entice the Jewish people to do sexual promiscuity and idolatry. And that worked, and 24,000 Jews died as a result of that. But be it as it may, the Torah says, do not allow Moabites and Ammonites to enter the Jewish people, because number one, they refused to give you food and water, and number two, they hired Bilam to curse you and cause you to stumble in tremendous sin. Now, this is all in the Chumash. Now, here's the question. Amalek, which is a nation that is so evil that we are supposed to destroy them and eradicate them and get rid of them, if they want to embrace Judaism with sincerity, we still welcome them. Ammon and Moab, who, you know, we're not supposed to kill them or anything. In fact, we're supposed to leave them alone. On one level, they're even worse than Amalek, because we were not makabel them. We don't accept them at all. So the explanation that's given is the following. Amalek is evil, indeed. But let's look at why did Amalek become such a bad guy? What made Amalek its riches? So if you remember, Amalek is the grandson of Esav. Esav had a son, Eliphaz. Eliphaz had a number of wives, but one of Eliphaz's concubines was Timnah. It was a concubine. And from Timnah, the union between Timnah and Eliphaz was this kid Amalek. Rashi brings a medrash that says, Timnah was actually of the nobility of Egypt, and she desperately wanted to marry into Abraham's family, because she saw this as holiness, and she wanted to, and she was willing to forsake her royalty in order to be connected to this family. The family rejected her because she was not righteous enough or good enough. So her attitude was, if I can't join Abraham's family on the good side, I'll join Abraham's family via the Esav. And from that came Amalek. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to say that you never know what the consequences of rejection are. That when you reject, when you close the door, when you tell somebody they're not good enough, that produces an Amalek in the world. Rav Chaim said this very specifically about the issue about expelling boys from yeshivas. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was, I don't know if you've heard of him now, because he's been nifter for more than 20 years, but he was the unforgettable Rosh Yeshiva of Mir. You know, Mir down the street here. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was not only a phenomenal Talmud Chacham, but a person of very, very deep emotion. Kind of a little bit of an unusual combination in some ways, but a person that, you know, he used to cry and sob during the reading of Rus. You know, he used to kind of always put himself in every picture. If he would see, if he'd walk by a shoe store and he would see baby shoes, you know, he would start crying. He'd say, oh, this is what this means to a mother to get, you know, like everything was, you know, he felt. So he used to say that he will not throw anyone out of the yeshiva, no matter what they do, unless they're actually influencing other people. Somebody could be on drugs, somebody could be an alcoholic. As long as they're not deliberately trying to get other people involved, he says. He is not going to reject anybody, because rejection produces amalek. And therefore, in a sense, again, this is a little difficult to articulate, because we don't want to suggest blame the victim. Like, we don't want to say, oh, it's the Jewish people's fault that there's amalek. You know, it's the Jewish people's fault that there's a Hitler, because Hitler was also, but the truth of the matter is Hitler also went through extreme rejection in various ways. Now, of course, everyone understands this does not excuse the rishus that a person does, because human beings have free will. But it does indicate that there could be a tragic consequence to the rejection we perpetrate on others. So therefore, in a sense, as evil as Amalek is, we still give them the avenue of joining the Jewish people. Because in a sense, Amalek was victimized. Although their behavior was not justifiable by that victimization. When it comes to Amon and Moab, though, the story is exactly the opposite. Amon and Moab come from Lot. Lot was beloved by Avraham. Avraham took care of Lot. Avraham shared all of his resources with Lot. And for the Moabites not to give us food and water after what Avraham did for Lot, it's the opposite. That wasn't rejection. It was a lack of hakaras hatov, a lack of gratitude for the goodness that was shown. And what the Torah is telling us is, a lack of hakaras hatov, a lack of capacity to be grateful, is such an evil and pernicious mida that we don't allow them to even attach themselves to the Jewish people. In other words, on some level we see a lack of gratitude, which may express itself passively, not giving you water, it's not even a sin of doing, is on some level more evil than the active evil I perpetrate in response to your rejection of me. Amalek is an active perpetrator of evil, indeed, but in response to the rejection they experienced. Moab is a passive withholder of gratitude in spite of the kindness they received. And in the hierarchy of moral condemnation, on one level, Ammon and Moab are considered to be worse. So you see how deeply the midah of hakaras hatov is required in Yiddishkeit.
Is this meant to suggest that Timna would have been Yaakov's wife?
Well, it's not clear. Yitzchak, this was before Yaakov. This would have been at Yitzchak's level. Yeah, but it would have been a concubine. It would not have been a wife per se. Yitzchak's wife was Yitzchak only had one wife. So this is the idea of hakaras hatov, and that's why Chazal say a person that does not have hakaras hatov, we have to suspect that perhaps they're not Jewish. Not to have hakaras hatov. So again, it's an important
Mussar. Sometimes when you say the people among someone, when people who are against Judaism and everything, like they pass that, you know, these people weren't Jewish initially, that were descended from, you know, Egyptians and all that. Is there any base to
them? There is a base. Again, we can't, Bizman Hazeh, we're not empowered to say definitively that somebody must not be Jewish, etc. Certainly, that is a distinct possibility. It says that if
a
person
the Gemara
uses in certain places that people who behave in certain ways, lo amdu avosav al har Sinai, his forefathers could not have been at Mount Sinai. There is such an expression for various things. The Gemara says that by three other midas too. It says anyone that's not rachmanim are compassionate. By shanim means bashful, but really it means humble, and people who do chesed to others. Rachmanim, by shanim, gam le chesedim. If one does not have those all three of those characteristics, then one suspects that their forefathers have not stood at Mount Sinai, that perhaps they're not even Jewish. Now again, as I say, as a practical halacha, we do not apply that today. In other words, nobody's going to say, hey, this guy doesn't have mercy, therefore he's not Jewish. And no one's going to paskin that way. But to show you how Chazal were so sensitive to what a Jewish neshama is, they actually thought that this was a chisaron in a person person's Jewishness.
Yeah.
Well, once again, what happened was this. Yeah, you're right. The people living in Jordan are not the ancient nations of Ammon and Moab. The Gemara tells us that when Sanherib, the king of Assyria, he exiled the 10 tribes, he had actually conquered the whole world, and he had moved all the populations all over the place. So the Moabites are somewhere, we don't even know, they might be extinct. So therefore, nobody is living where they originally lived. That's why, obviously, the ancient Egyptians are not in Egypt, right? The Egyptians now are an Arabic people. They are not the ancient Egyptians. The Arabic people come from Ishmael. The ancient Egyptians, and Ishmael is a Semite, a Semitic people, the ancient Egyptians came from Ham, right? So they're a different, whole different branch of humanity. Well, again, there's some question about that, because one of Ham's children was Cush. And Cush is said to be the father of the black nation. So it's not clear if the blackness was Ham himself, or the blackness was one of his children that came. You know, there's some machlokas. If Cush was the Shachar, or Ham himself was the Shachar. Although, the truth of the matter is, you know, in the United States, there's a big agitation among the black community called Afrocentrism, in which they do want to show, indeed, that a lot of the ancient cultures were black. They make the case for Egypt, which is very plausible, very possible indeed, and they also make the case for Greece and Rome, which is almost impossible. So, but they try to you know, make that point.
So I
saw a fragment of ancient Greek pottery, which depicted Egyptians as Negroid people.
Yes. Again, even based on the Chumash, it's a very, very plausible thing, because among Ham's children was Cush and Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was one of Ham's children, and if Ham himself was Shachar, and that was a result of the curse or whatever it is, that would logically pass over to Mitzrayim. On the other hand, Yavan, Greece, comes from Yepes, which is the other son of Noah. And you know, there'd be no indication of that there. So I could certainly accept the possibility of a Negro culture in Egypt. Although again, I think the pottery is equivocal, because you have it both ways. I think, in other words, don't we have things from as old as ancient Egypt, which you don't necessarily see there?
Sure. And the Egyptians, it's difficult to
tell the difference, the nature of that.
They didn't necessarily, the ancient Egyptians weren't necessarily devoted towards realism. Mm-hmm. It was the way they depicted themselves, not necessarily the way they looked.
Right.
And
right.
I would go more towards the Greeks, because they were more into
realism. Yeah.
They were. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, I also heard, I don't remember where I saw this, if this was an Afrocentrism thing, that Aristotle himself, the great philosopher Aristotle, may have been black, you know, Negro in that sense. But you know, we don't know. I mean, so certainly it is absolutely possible. Yeah.
In I studied a little bit of Egyptology. I know within the Egyptian culture itself, it was kind of like more pure. It would be lighter. And something about men and women, like the famous statue pair of man and woman. The man was dark. It would just be the men were outside and women were inside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes you see the king be very light.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's higher, or it could just be that the nobles were inside.
Yeah, it's hard to know. But you know, there was an amazing thing. You know, one of the interesting phenomena, I don't want to get into it too much because that's not something to give the Megillah, but one of the interesting phenomena in racial relations in the United States was discrimination. I know in Washington, D.C., this was a problem. Discrimination among black communities based on the degree of darkness of the skin. I mean, it's hard for us to even imagine this was an issue. It was a very, very big issue that the lighter skins considered the darker skin to be inferior. And in one of the churches in Washington, D.C., and I mean, not anymore, but they keep it up there as a remembrance, there was actually a color card of a shade of brown, and if you were darker than that shade, you were not allowed admission into that church. You had to pass a test.
Yes. I remember as a child,
Which is, of course, the ultimate. Again, this has an analogy to feminism, by the way, because that type of attitude says that's the ultimate debasement of one's self-image by saying, I only achieve meaning and significance when I become something else. And to make it relevant to Torah, which is our job here, this is really one of the issues against feminism. That a lot of feminist rhetoric is basically defining male as significant, as important, as meaningful, and therefore a woman's meaning is defined only to the degree she can do what a man does. So on one level people say, well, that's equality of women. On the other hand, one might suggest that is the ultimate denigration of women, because it does not seek a meaning within a woman's life. It seeks a meaning by making it like a man. Because when a woman says, you know, I gotta read the Torah too, I gotta be a chazan too, I gotta be a rabbi too, what that's saying is everything important in life is what men do. And the ultimate significance is to find within what a woman does how that is important. Now, it might be a man's fault for not recognizing it. I'm not here that. But still, the idea of imitating somebody else is the ultimate debasement of the chashivas of one's own life. So even on a very simple level, you can see that feminism is actually anti-women to some degree, because it defines meaning in life by what men do. So there is a connection there. Okay. Alright, so we now come to Haman, and Haman was lifted. According to Chazal, Haman was the richest guy in the world. He was richer than his king. By the way, that's not impossible. I read that, you know, Queen Elizabeth is very, very wealthy, but there are 5 hereditary noblemen in Great Britain that are actually wealthier than the queen, you know, so Haman was even wealthier than Ahasuerus. And in fact, we will see that when he wanted to kill the Jews, he offered 10,000 kikar, 10,000 talents of silver. Now, I saw a calculator, I don't remember all the details of the calculation, but 10,000 talents of silver in contemporary prices would have been something like $1 billion, if you go with what the talent is and the ounces and everything else. So, you know, Haman is able to throw that around and presumably still remain wealthy. He didn't give everything away, right? So Haman was very, very wealthy. And it talks about the fact that Haman required that everybody bow down to him. And the king validated this. But look at Pasuk Beis. Pasuk Beis says, V'chol avdei hamelech, all of the servants of the king, asher b'shar hamelech, that were in the king's gates, Korim u'mishtachavim lahaman. Right, these are 2 phrases. Korim, like we say in Olenu, anachnu korim u'mishtachavim. What's the difference between korim u'mishtachavim? Korim means to bend the knee. To be korea al-birkav is to bend your knees. To be mishtachaveh is to lower your body. Now sometimes korim u'mishtachavim might actually mean you get on your knees and you bend your body in that type of submissive bow. Sometimes it just means you bend your knee and you bow without necessarily getting on the ground. Presumably, in this context, based on the way these cultures operated, Korim actually meant you got on your knees and then you bent your body forward. Now, it says here, Mordechai didn't do it. Now, let me ask you this. This is actually a general question. Granted, Jews don't worship idols. Okay, and the halacha is a Jew must give his life before he bows down to an idol. Right? That's pashut. You must give up your life before you bow down. But is there a principle that says Jews are not allowed to bow down? In other words, bowing down does not always mean a symbol of worship, of divine worship. people walked by and they would bow down to a king, not because the king was necessarily a god, right? Or let's say you're introduced to Queen Elizabeth, right? Even today, people don't get on the floor and bow down, but you know, you. Or we introduce, right, even the concept of nodding to somebody, right, is a remnant of the concept of bowing down. So l'chaira, halacha does not in itself prohibit the physical act of bowing, right? No, these people don't. Right? It is not forbidden to bow. It is forbidden to worship and express the idea that something is divine. Social bowing is bichlal not usur. So the question is, why did Mordechai make such a big deal about not bowing down? So the Gemara here tells us the following. The Gemara here tells us, obviously, therefore, Haman's insistence that people bow down to him was not merely a function of deference to the king's officers, but in fact, Haman used to keep an idol. He used to keep an idol attached to his clothes, and he wanted people to worship and acknowledge this idol as a god. And ultimately, that Haman was this god's emissary on earth. So there was a concept here of divinity. Now you may say, gee, how could people believe this guy was divine? But again, in the ancient world, a lot of the kings proclaimed themselves divine, and Haman himself, therefore, this is dealing with Avodah Zarah. This is not dealing with social bowing. It's dealing with Avodah Zarah. But you'll notice, look at the end of the pasuk. So apparently, though, everybody bowed down except Mordechai. When I say everybody, that means even the Jews bowed down. Right? The Jews bowed down, but it says Mordechai didn't do it.
There could be another meaning this pasuk. It says, "Becholatei
Hamelech,
Asher b'Shar Hamelech." So the ones who were in the Shar Hamelech were the judges. So there could probably mean that the judges were bowing down, were corrupting themselves for Haman.
Yes.
Except for Mordechai, who.
So you're saying it might refer to a whole different thing. In other words, that's a very interesting point. As your suggestion is that maybe we're not dealing with idolatry. We're dealing with judicial corruption. In other words, the concept of bowing down means that judges would decide cases in accordance with whatever Haman wanted, and Mordechai was the only one who was not corruptible. That's a very interesting pshat. That's why there's a reference to the Avdei HaMelech Asher Bashar HaMelech. Remember, we talked about those who are in the king's gates might be a specific reference to the judges. That's an excellent pshat. Chazal understand this as Avodah Zarah. Now, one thing, it says, you'll notice though, Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Now, grammatically, this is difficult. Yichra and yishtachaveh are future. See, the pasuk should read, like, how does the art scroll translate it? The art scroll translates it, Mordechai would not bow down. But literally it means Mordechai will not bow down. It should have said, Mordechai lo kara v'lo hishtachava. Why does it say lo yichra v'lo yishtachava? So here the Shem Mishmol, one of the great Hasidic writings, say that Mordechai in this sense is symbolic of the courage of the Jew in every generation. That just like in that generation there was a Mordechai who didn't bow down, so too, in every generation of adversity of Chal Yisrael, there will be the Mordechai who will not bow down and will not. In other words, this is a declaration that no matter how bad things will get for the Jewish people, there will always be a Jew or a group of Jews who will be faithful to Hashem no matter what. That's Mordechai lo yichra. In other words, it's kind of, as we're reading this Megillah, the Baal Koreh is reminding us that not only was there a Mordechai who didn't, but there will always be a Mordechai who won't. It's kind of that idea. But the simple meaning is the following. The simple meaning is that this is what's going through Haman's mind. If Mordechai didn't do it today, but Haman figures if there's enough pressure, Mordechai will eventually come around, so Haman might forget it for today. But what gets Haman mad is, hey, it's not only that he didn't do it, but I know he's never going to do it. And that's why Haman is determined to take some action. Now, it's very interesting. The Gemara tells us the following. The Gemara adds a certain detail here that's very, very fascinating. And that is This is not the first time that Haman and Achashverosh have had some, Haman and Mordechai have had some relationship. And it wasn't simply, imagine the scene. Haman walks by, and all of the Avdei HaMelech, the big judges, are bowing down. And here you have this man, Mordechai, who's just sitting in his place. And keep in mind that Mordechai doesn't do this in a modest way. After all, Mordechai could have just gone at home. Mordechai could have stayed at home. But Mordechai, you know, keeps his seat, Bashar HaMelech. And as everybody's going crazy, as Haman walks by, you know, Mordechai is continuing to read the newspaper or whatever Mordechai is doing, as if there's nothing important going on here. And this fills Haman with rage and anger. But the Gemara adds a certain detail. He says, years before, Haman and Mordechai were in the army together. And Haman ran out of his supplies, he needed food, and Mordechai agreed. Haman was a barber originally, and he was in the army, he needed food. So Mordechai agreed, and Haman... Haman's profession was a barber, yes. Yes. That's why we'll find later, when Haman has to lead Mordechai through the streets, Mordechai insists that Haman give him the haircut. He says, Haman, you know how to do this well. I will see. And Haman was a barber, and he was poor really at the time. And he had written Mordechai a document, similar to the Yaakov and Esau story in some way, saying that if you give me the food, I sell myself as your slave for life. And he writes on the bottom of Mordechai's shoe, I am your slave, signed Haman. So Chazal say that although Mordechai never pushed this on Haman, but every time Haman walked by, Mordechai would show him the bottom of his shoe. That says, remember Haman, don't be too self-aggrandizing. So you can see that Haman is filled with this, with the anger and this fury. But one thing I just want to make a point, that Haman's approach to taking the personal slight and universalizing it is consistent with what he did with Achashverosh. Remember, Achashverosh gets insulted by his wife? But what does Memuchan, who's Haman, say? You can't let this pass, Your Majesty, because the whole kingdom will learn from this that wives don't have to respect their husbands. Same thing here.